Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaietis, Judge Siegel, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Theodora Gaietis presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is November 17th, 2023, and we are hearing our calendar this morning on the Zoom platform. We have just one case before us this morning, and this matter was rescheduled from last week's calendar. The matter is case number A230661 in re R.A. Morin Trust versus Paul Morin and several other district court matters involving the trust and estates of Robert Morin. Just a few comments before we turn things over to the attorneys this morning in this case. First, I would like to make sure that the attorneys can see the judges and also maybe even more importantly, the clock that is displayed on the screen. Can you both see that? And you can just nod if you can. Perfect. So that clock will be counting down the time for your arguments this morning. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes to present. Counsel for respondent will then have 15 minutes. And counsel for appellant, you will have a 5-minute rebuttal opportunity, regardless of how much time you take during your principal argument. We are making an audio recording of the argument this morning, which will be available on the court's website shortly. And to ensure that everything in that recording is clear, I ask that you please identify yourself and the party you're representing before you begin to present your argument. And then, as we're all accustomed to now with our Zoom use, please just make sure that your audio is in the mute setting when you are not the attorney presenting your argument. That concludes my remarks. I think we're ready to go here. So I will put myself in mute and turn things over to counsel for the appellant. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. My name is Sean Snyder, John, and I'm appearing on behalf of Paul Morin, the appellant. This is a case about property rights, principally, and what happens when a person's property rights are badly violated at the end of their life with their life savings. Robert Morin and his wife, Rosemary, made a trust in 2014. They each made their own trust. They were both beneficiaries of their trusts. If you look at Exhibits 1 and 2, whether they're living, when Rosemary died, Robert became the beneficiary in Robert's trust. He was the beneficiary whether he was disabled or not disabled. So the district court's finding that all along this plan for the money to go to the kids in an irrevocable trust is plainly against the language of the trust, and it's clearly erroneous, and it's what sets this whole case off. In June 2019, Robert wanted to direct money from the Rosemary Morin Trust. He wanted to give some money to his church. His children said, no, it's an irrevocable trust. You can't do that. You can't do anything. Sorry. He got very angry, and the record bears it out. He wanted to control, the district court admits that he wants to control his affairs. And so it was very difficult for him in this regard. And so he threatens
I interject just 1 minute? So if you could just clarify for me, because I didn't think the issue of the transfer of money and the handling of Mrs. Morin's trust was in front of us today. I mean, so if you could just clear that up, or is that just like kind of background? Background explanation. Okay, thanks. Yeah,
maybe why he's threatening to disinherit his children here, why he's so angry about this. He does a lot of things in June 2019, July 2019. He's threatening to disinherit them, and he's threatening to get his own attorney. He wants his own attorney. Richard Gabriel is protecting the trust. His children are protecting the trust, and he wants to get his own attorney. He says in the emails that he wants to get a high-powered attorney. And so Paul Morin goes and meets Cheryl picks Cheryl Morrison, but he's acting as an agent for Robert. Robert wants to get his own attorney, and that's clear from the record. So any district court findings that this is, you know, kind of like the Norlander case or the Shaughnessy case where Paul just sneaks off and gets him to sign something, that's not what's going on here, because Robert is angry about his property and he wants to get his own attorney. Another key, clearly erroneous finding is that Mark and Lisa eventually helped Robert give money to the church. That is clearly erroneous. They were not, they didn't eventually do it because they were good-hearted people. They were forced to do it. And if you look at exhibits, trial exhibits 69 and 70, it's clear that they start doing things. They start helping once they find out that Cheryl Morrison has been involved in this matter. So especially numbers trial exhibit 69, you can see that Mark Morin is a little bit anxious because he sees that now an attorney is involved. So it cannot be said that this whole thing was hidden from view, because that email shows that Mark Morin knew about Cheryl Morrison. And
Mr. Snyderson, I am getting from your argument that what you're asking us to do is to reweigh the evidence, which is something we're expressly prohibited from doing under the law. Aren't we required to give deference to the district court's findings? And, you know, I certainly if those findings contradict the record, they would be clearly erroneous. But what I'm hearing is a request from you to make alternative factual findings, which we're just as the reviewing court not allowed to do, right?
Yes. And that's why I'm pointing out that these are contrary facts that support different findings. And there's also a de novo review of the law here with testamentary capacity and undue influence. And I'm arguing to the court and asking the court to reverse this decision, because all of the points here are against the law that's cited and the law that's on the books here in Minnesota. So another finding that the court makes is that Paul just makes up his own he manufactures his own grievances for Robert, that you know, he's just making up out of thin air to get Robert to disinherit. But everything Paul says in the record is supported, especially with theft of money. He asks, if you look at trial exhibit, my addendum 11 through 16, he's asking for $36,000 to be accounted for, and Mark Morin just says, oh, it's spent on the house. There's another part of this case where Mark bought a lot from the Rosemary Morin Trust for $20,000. And so just to say that, oh, $36,000 was spent on the house, that's not a good accounting.
So, counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I tend to agree with where my colleagues are going. Shouldn't the focus here today be on testamentary capacity and undue influence? I mean, we're seeming to get into evidentiary disputes that were resolved by the district court. And those are the issues, I think, that are in front of us, the main legal issues that you want to address.
I'm through with the background, and I will move on to testamentary capacity.
Well, let me just ask you, as you address that, why this isn't, again, primarily a credibility determination, including medical testimony that was unrebutted.
I believe it was rebutted by Cheryl Morrison. Dr. Orr's report, if you look at Exhibit 154, he says in December 2019 and October 2019, when Robert made those documents, that it could not be concluded medically that he did not have testamentary capacity. So the court, for one, there's a couple arguments here. For one, it goes beyond his actual report. Two, he says that out of all the medical record, the most thorough workup of Robert's dementia is January 2020. Robert has moderate dementia. Moderate dementia is a legal matter. It does not preclude testamentary capacity. And even the medical definition of moderate dementia, people have trouble remembering dates, but they still know significant events that are going on in their family. And the record bears out that Robert knew. Even there's testimony in December 2019, Ann Warren Jansen testified that her father knew his family, and he knew significant events going on. When he talks to Rebecca Julich in January 2020, he knows where his children are living, he knows about his property, and he knows that he's...
However, I would just note that Dr. Orr pointed out in his report that dementia is one of those kinds of diseases or impairments that sort of fluctuates on a day-to-day basis. And so I'm unclear as to how those things are inconsistent with that factual finding.
So there's no proof that Robert was experiencing worse dementia on the days in question. Even his own report says October 2019 and December 2019, he can't make a clear decision about whether he had capacity or not. He said it wasn't possible to do that medically. Now, looking at Cheryl Morrison's testimony, Cheryl Morrison, and I want to look at something, Mr. Cassiope on cross-examination, he has the videos and he's cross-examining Ms. Morrison. Ms. Morrison, trial page 479, lines 15 through 23, he says, and that's when Robert said that he had $500,000, right, in this account. And Ms. Morrison says, yes, when he said that, when Robert said $500,000 affirmatively, that is when, you know, she says Bob was consistent as to his understanding of that account and all my dealings. She had met with him 9 to 10 times. She talked to him or met with him in person. She had at least 9 points of contact. And the whole time he was saying $500,000, $500,000. So how can it be said that he didn't know?
I'll just interrupt you again. The district court in its order found that Ms. Morrison's testimony was credible as to her own personal beliefs, but also found that on balance, her testimony regarding Robert's capacity was inconsistent with the other evidence in the case. And I'm not sure, again, given our standard of review and the requirement that we defer to those, you know, credibility findings that the district and factual findings that the district court made, that we can simply set that aside. And if we can, please let us know how.
My response to that would be, if Robert is affirmatively saying he has $500,000 and she's not saying you have $500,000, and then you look at the evidence in the record, the statement says $536,000. Then he knows the value of that account. And he should be able to correct it. Because testamentary capacity, you have to know the nature and extent of your estate. He says he has $500,000 here, which he does. And you have to know the objects of your bounty. He knows he's disinheriting Lisa, and he later even says that he's disinheriting Mark and Lisa. So those are the key facts with testamentary capacity and the findings that Cheryl Morrison didn't know what she was talking about. That's not supported by this record.
So just to understand your argument, so you're saying there's some points in the videotape where he knows, you know, he said $500,000. Are you arguing that the district court viewed the videos and came to its own conclusion about whether overall Robert showed he had testamentary capacity? And decided he didn't. So is it your position that that's outside the district court's jurisdiction to do that? Jurisdiction is probably, you know, their proper role. Is it that you need an expert? You say Morrison says one thing, or, you know, is at least, you know, said he couldn't say with to a degree of medical certainty in the earlier dates. So did the district court have the right to view the video and say, I don't think this meets the legal standard, or did he need somebody saying it doesn't?
I think
an expert, for example.
I think the district court erred when it said basically Cheryl Morrison didn't know what she was talking about. The evidence didn't support her. And then he didn't make a finding that it did support her. That there was, he did affirmatively say $500,000, and it was consistent with what he had been saying. So that's a clearly erroneous finding when the issue is testamentary capacity. I don't think a court has the discretion just to ignore that kind of evidence and to say that the witness didn't know what she was talking about when there is a basis that she did know what she was talking about. And another thing, like if you look at that Darkenwald case, which the trial court uses, and that's a similar situation. There, the cross-examining attorney took medical records and he convinced the attorney that they were wrong. Here, the attorney did not do that. The attorney on cross-examination had all the medical evidence. He could have changed Ms. Morrison's mind, but he couldn't do that because she was, you know, there's this $500,000 account statement in the record. So the finding is wrong and the application of the law here is wrong. With undue influence, again, to align this case with the Olson case, the district court makes an erroneous finding by leaving out the fact that Robert says, January 2020, I've already disinherited Mark and Lisa, and I plan on leaving my estate to Paul. A similar thing happened in the Olson case, and the trial court gave it a lot of weight because it shows volition. It shows this person was premeditating this and he was planning this.
But again, we're an appellate court, and the appellate court, I read Olson and I was a little confused about why you were relying on it so heavily, because the appellate court just affirmed the district court. It didn't reverse the district court and the district court's findings and credibility findings. And here you're asking us to actually reverse.
I think that the district court made an error in its finding with Ms. Julich's testimony by leaving out evidence that Robert was acting volitionally. And if the whole issue is undue influence and testamentary capacity, and the court's just leaving these things out, that's clearly erroneous. One last thing here, I have about a minute. When he disinherits Mark and Lisa, December 18th, 2019 is when he signs those documents. Objectively speaking, the day before that, he gets bad news. He's been trying to get his trust back, the Rosemary Morin Trust. He's been in litigation with his children over this. Not litigation, but he's been in negotiation. And they say, we want to put you under conservatorship. And we don't know anything about the funding of the Rosemary Morin Trust. And by the way, we'll give you some money if you need it, you know, maybe, because Lisa said she wouldn't do that. The medical record shows that he's mad. That same day, the same day that email comes out, he's mad. And the next day, he disinherits them. So any behavior of Paul, and the district court's rationale here is obviously to look at Paul's character. But at the time of the disinheritance, which is the relevant law here, it's at the time, not days before, days after, weeks before, at the time, Robert had capacity, he was not unduly influenced. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much for your argument. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it after respondent's argument. And excuse me, now we will turn to counsel for respondent. We have the clock ready for you and you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Anne Rondoni Tavernier and I represent respondents and petitioners below Mark Morin, Ann Morin Jansen, and Lisa Kamensend. And with me today off camera is my colleague, Joe Cassiope. Your Honors, before I begin my general comments, I would like to just briefly address a few statements made by Mr. Schneiderjohn that require correction. First, Cheryl Morrison was not testifying as an expert and so did not provide expert rebuttal to Dr. Orr's testimony or report. Second, Dr. Orr did not make a determination on Robert Morin's capacity on October 2019 and December 2019. What he found was that he could not make a determination within a degree of medical certainty as to capacity at that time. He does say in his report that he has very serious concerns about Robert's capacity and that Robert was very seriously impaired at that time. But the reason why he couldn't make a medical certainty determination was because of the extensive prompting by Ms. Morrison asking Robert Morin and reminding him about the nature of his assets, and said that without that prompting and without drilling down further, he was unable to conclude within medical certainty whether Robert, without that prompting, would have understood the nature and extent of his assets. And specifically with respect to the $500,000, that statement was made only after Robert first could not remember what the documents he was signing pertained to. Then when Ms. Morrison prompted him again that it was related to his Morgan Stanley IRA, he said that account only related to a few thousand dollars. And then on a third time when Ms. Morrison said, no, this is your primary account, at that point did he make a statement about the amount of money in the account. Your Honors, as each of you have noted, the sole issue on appeal today is whether the district court's findings of fact were clearly erroneous. The parties agree on what the law is. There is no need for de novo review here. Appellant is asking the court to step into the shoes of the trial court and reweigh the evidence. But the Rule 52 standard of review prohibits this. Under Rule 52.01, Judge Sean Moynihan's findings of fact are only clearly erroneous if they are, quote, manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole, end quote. That's from Matter of Commitment of Kenny, 963 Northwest 2nd, 214. The district court's thorough post-trial order reflects that the documentary and testimonial evidence abundantly support the conclusions that Robert Morin's estate plans were invalid due to lack of testamentary capacity and because those plans were the product of Paul's abusive, threatening, and manipulative behavior.
But, and I'll just... the district court noted in the order that the issues of testamentary capacity and undue influence were separate issues and sort of either one could invalidate the signings. But the district court also noted that the two issues were intertwined in that, you know, because according to respondents, Robert had diminished capacity, he was more susceptible to undue influence. And I'm just wondering where you stand on that issue or where respondents stand on that issue. Could we affirm based on either of these things, or are they intertwined to such an extent that one is dependent upon the other?
Yes, Your Honors can affirm based on either ground. Both are sufficient to bring about the result of affirming the district court's ultimate findings. They're intertwined in that the sixth Peterson factor, exercise of persuasion, takes into account the testator's age and cognitive health. But that factor also takes into account many other elements. And while the district court relied upon Robert Morin's diminished capacity in assessing that sixth factor, the trial court also made specific findings about Robert's manipulative behavior that also supported the finding that exercise of persuasion. That includes that Paul was skilled at communicating threats to anybody who he felt stood in his way, that he had previously verbally abused his parents, other caregivers, that he was overall skilled in guilt manipulation. So while the two elements of this case, undue influence and lack of testamentary capacity, are intertwined in that they both relate to a degree of cognitive health, overturning one does not require overturning the other. And Your Honors, though there has been a lot of discussion of what may constitute error here today, subject to any other questions from the court, I'd like to focus my argument on two primary points of contention. The first is the testimony of Cheryl Morrison on testamentary capacity, and the second is the impact of Robert Morin's strong will on undue influence. On reviewing the trial court's determinations, this court does not resolve conflicting evidence and provides deference to the trial court's witness credibility determinations. That standard forecloses Paul's argument that Ms. Morrison's testimony on Robert's capacity should have outweighed all other evidence to the contrary. And Your Honors, because there are multiple Morins here, I'm going to use first names for clarity. At trial, Ms. Morrison testified as to her belief that Robert had capacity, despite evidence that prior to the first signing in October 2019, she had reviewed Robert's diagnosis of dementia, suggested that they get a new determination as to his capacity, and that was never done. The trial court found that Ms. Morrison's testimony was inconsistent with the medical evidence, the video evidence, and the other testimonial and documentary evidence that reflected Robert's lack of capacity. In arguing that the trial court did not place sufficient weight on Ms. Morrison's testimony, Paul would have the court disregard the opinions of multiple treating physicians, the voluminous medical records, the unrebutted expert testimony of Dr. Orr, the video evidence reflecting Robert's clear cognitive deficits and the other testimonial evidence from the parties. Paul is asking this court to step into the shoes of the trial court, reweigh Ms. Morrison's testimony and all of the other evidence on capacity, and come to the opposite conclusion because he disagreed with the trial court's conclusion. This is not justified by the facts or permitted by the standard of review. The trial court did not err in assigning Ms. Morrison's testimony limited weight and finding that the overwhelming body of evidence established lack of testamentary capacity on each of the dates in question. As to undue influence, the primary allegation made by Paul is that the court did not place sufficient emphasis on Robert's strong-willed attitude. And again, on review, this court does not resolve conflicting evidence and views the trial court's determinations in a favorable light. The trial court's decision on this issue was also fully consistent with the evidence. The trial court found that while Robert retained a desire to control his affairs, he had become, quote, impulsive and driven by grievance, end quote, and that this was manifested through rationalizations and scripts he had been fed by Paul. In other words, Robert's desire to maintain control over his affairs was a personality trait, but his goals for those affairs was a product of Paul. This was a symptom of the undue influence rather than evidence to controvert it. The evidence shows that Paul manipulated Robert's strong-willed attitude to work in his favor. The trial court indeed found that Paul took advantage of Robert's significantly reduced mental capacity to manipulate Robert into disinheriting his siblings. Pointedly, the trial court stated, quote, Robert was no match for Paul, end quote. Ultimately, failure to place greater evidence on the strong-willed personality of Robert does not reveal clear error on any point, much less error that would justify overturning the determination of undue influence. Your Honors, I'd like to briefly also address the charge of bias that Paul raised in his briefing. There are two problems.
Can I ask? I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Schneider-Dent, and that is, did the court act appropriately in coming to its own conclusion based on the video of whether Robert had testamentary capacity or not? Or do you need an expert to opine?
We do not need an expert to opine on the effect of the video evidence. And I would also state that the trial court relied on the video evidence in making its determination on lack of capacity, but also relied on other evidence, including the medical records that demonstrated Robert's degenerative and progressive issues with dementia, the testimony of the parties for years prior and including up to the time and around when the estate plans were signed that their father did not understand numbers, the testimony of third parties that it was clear that his understanding of the events was muddled, that he couldn't form coherent thoughts about it. So while the trial court did rely on the videos, that reliance was perfectly appropriate. And the ultimate determination of lack of capacity included other evidentiary determinations. And on the Rule 52 standard of review, that is the question, is whether the findings were contrary to the weight of the evidence as a whole. Returning, Your Honors, I'd like to just briefly address the bias issue raised in briefing. There are two issues with this argument. First, legally, Paul has forfeited this argument because it was not raised with the trial court below. Under the Funchess v. Cecil Newman case, 632 Northwest 2nd 666, this court can only consider issues presented to and considered by the trial court. It was not raised below and so cannot be considered here. Second, there is a serious factual problem with this argument, and that is what Paul calls bias is really the district court finding that Paul's abhorrent behavior toward a multitude of individuals was evidence of his ability to engage in guilt manipulation to get what he wanted. Unless the court has any other questions, I would finally state that appellant disagrees with how the court interpreted the evidence and weighed testimony. But disagreement is simply insufficient to establish clear error. The trial court's findings should be affirmed, and the respondents request that the appeal be denied. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. We will now go back to counsel for appellant. We're getting the clock reset here with 5 minutes that you may use if you would like to offer a rebuttal argument. And you are mute. Let's start again.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry about that. So a couple of points here. For this court to reverse the district court, there needs to be the findings are contrary to the weight of the evidence, which is what Ms. Tavernier said. And I'd like to just look at a couple of the statements that she addressed. She said, Robert became impulsive and driven by grievance. 2 points there. He'd been grieved over his property for many, many months. And that was something that was important to him. And it started with him. Two, his conversation with Rebecca Julich in January 2020 shows that he planned on disinheriting Anne at a later time. So how that could not be impulsive. A finding of impulsivity is not supported there. When he says that Robert is no match for Paul, again, look at Rebecca Julich's testimony where he says he's disinherited Mark and Lisa. He plans to disinherit Anne. The record shows Paul is the most upset and most angry with Anne, the one who Robert decides to disinherit later. So it cannot be said that Robert is no match for Paul. He is a match for Paul. He's saying, okay, we could do that, but we're going to do that later. So the district court's findings are not supported and they should be reversed. Another element of undue influence is that the document has to singularly benefit the undue influencer. Here, that's clearly erroneous because the will in October 2019 benefits all four children. And the documents in December 2019 and January 2020 give half the estate to Anne. Her share goes up when Robert signed those documents. So that's clearly erroneous. It's contradicted by the documents themselves. Lastly, the medical expert's opinion that he couldn't decide whether Robert had testamentary capacity or not in October 2019 or December 2019, but he could, his report said he could determine certainty in January 2020 and March 2020. Ms. Morrison testified that the January 2020 disinheritance of Mark and Lisa off the trust was a continuation. It was a finalizing of what Robert had told her to do in December, on December 18th, 2019. So she didn't go into as much detail. There were yes or no questions, but her testimony was that she was just wrapping things up. And so how can it be said that he didn't have capacity when she was just following through? Another thing she testified, she's been an attorney since 1988. She has a lot of experience. She's drafted, she says, hundreds or thousands of wills.
Wait, just to understand your argument, are you saying that because he had testamentary capacity in late 2019, that in Ms. Morrison testified that she was just following through on his wishes then, that he didn't need to have testamentary capacity when he signed in March 2020?
I'm saying the expert's argument there is flawed because he bases his opinion on January 2020 that he was just answering yes or no questions. But it was a continuation, and Ms. Morrison testified that most people don't understand the beneficiary designations, wills, and trusts, all the complexities of that. Most people don't understand that. So he could have just as well signed that in December 2019. And also, there's nothing medically that says on that date Robert was, you know, worse off or anything like that. He was just agreeing, yes, I still want to disinherit Mark and Lisa. So the court's findings there are erroneous. And the same could be said for the March 2020. There's nothing. You know, Robert said he planned to do it in January of 2020. And so months later, during COVID lockdown, he signed the form removing Anne as the beneficiary, as he said he would do months earlier in open air in the cafeteria in the senior apartment. And that concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for the arguments that you presented to the court today. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. Because this was the only case on our calendar today, this concludes the calendar for November 17th. Thank you all for being here.